Welcome to the last concurrent for the forum. This is on the employer covenant. It's going to be presented by Andrew Boll. And for anyone who was present to the previous one I chaired before lunch, I hope this one goes much more smoothly. You know, they went to extreme lengths to make super a bit more interesting, but it wasn't what we needed. Anyway, so to Andrew. Andrew is the managing director of What's More Wide in Australia.
Yeah,
It says.
It's an old one, obviously.
No. You know what? It says Towers Watson in front of me.
Oh, okay.
So I'll start again, shall I? Andrew is the managing director of Towers Watson in Australia. He also sits on the organisation's Asia Pacific Leadership Group, the management team responsible for shaping the future of Towers Watson in the region. With over 26 years consulting experience in the superannuation and employee benefits industries, Andrew is responsible for managing key client relationships and developing strategic solutions for several major clients. He also plays an important role in driving Towers Watson's research efforts in Australia and has authored such reports as the superannuation guarantee is 9% enough. Well, we've learned. He's the convener of the Institute of Actuaries Superannuation and Employee Benefits Practice Committee and has been examiner and tutor for superannuation. Thank you.
Nothing changed since lunchtime.
This session sort of sprang up out of some discussions we were having at the Superannuation Practice Committee last year when we were working on PS400, and some of the feedback we received from some members in the member consultation process was around the employer-sponsor covenant and how that's dealt with when dealing with the trustee's responsibilities and the actuary's responsibilities in funding a defined benefit superannuation plan. So it was, I thought it was worthwhile having a session just on this in here just for people to have a discussion forum about the issues. I'll talk through some of the issues we discussed at the within the Superannuation Practice Committee about it at different stages during the session. If you were expecting to see a co-presenter, John Newman, here today, it's unfortunate. I won't be offended if you leave now because John's not here. But John's been unwell lately, so I understand he's on the mend. But thanks very much. I shouldn't have said that. I've got a half a presentation, so I'm going to aim to get you out of here well and truly early and be the first session, the concurrent session, to finish. One of the things that, just before I go on with that, when we got the feedback from one of the members, we were quoted seven particular references in PS400 where the employer-sponsor covenant was either specifically addressed or implied in PS400. And so the question was really asked of the committee about whether or not we should be giving guidance to actuaries on how to deal with the issue of the employer-sponsor covenant in PS400. So I then, as a group, we turned. There was some work done on this in the UK about 5 years ago. And in fact, if you're not familiar with the UK position on this, there's the Pensions Regulator, or TPR for short. They issue codes of practice, and they've issued 12 codes of practice. And number three of that code of practice is called Funding Defined Benefits. And if you go on and Google the Pensions Regulator in the UK, you'll be able to get a copy of that document. Inside that document, that goes through a large number of paragraphs, they're all numbered. I've brought four of those out here in this presentation. So you can see there, in fact, reading through those, it's essential for the trustees to form an objective assessment of the employer's financial position and prospects, as well as its willingness to continue to fund the pension plan's benefits. And that's what they're called in brackets, the employer's covenant. I won't go read through the other three, which you can do now as we continue to go through this. But basically, the employer covenant is the extent to which a trustee can rely on the employer's willingness and ability to pay future contributions. So it's an important part for actuaries to think about that when in framing our recommendations whether the company is actually going to be able to pay them. So in the UK context, and I was in contact with some of our UK colleagues to help prepare some of the material for this presentation, but this is the way that some of these slides are directly provided to me by my colleagues over there. So this is how the issue is being addressed in the UK. But the main things that are looked at there are the financial strength of the employer and the affordability of future contributions. Technical provisions is the way they describe in the UK the funded position really against the liability. So in Australia you might regard the technical provisions to be vested benefits or the actuarial accrued value of benefits. In the UK they call that just collectively the technical provisions, and whether they're over or underfunded. And then the recovery plan. I have some slides in a moment about the durations of recovery plans, which are quite different to the Australian experience. The key issues there obviously are if you have a shortfall, how should that be eliminated, how quickly or how long the duration is acceptable to the regulator, to the trustee, and other issues such as what security is placed around those future contributions and what other measures might be adopted to help the trustee improve the security of the provision of members' benefits. This is a... You're not meant to read the right-hand side, so that's okay. This is just a snapshot of things changed in the UK. That this was the regulator issued their guidance on the 22nd of September 2005, but then the world changed a few years later. And this on the right-hand side, this was a document released to the industry by the pensions regulator in October 2008. So basically, if you're having a look at that down the bottom. And the pause there for speaking, so I come back to the microphone. Those dates down there are the dates of 1 year duration. The first period, which is the tranche one in orange, is from 20 September 2005 to 2006. So that's the date that the regulator first issued this document. And for the next any actuarial valuation with an effective date in the following 12 months, that tranche one is the duration, the average duration of the funding of any deficits. So as you can see then, it was almost 9 year periods was the average period over which deficits were on average permitted to be funded going forward. That reduced down to about 7.5 years for valuations done between 2006 and 2007, and back up again to a bit over 8 years for 2007 to 2008. So obviously those durations will be fluctuating depending on the size of the deficits and the experience of the funds, so the investment performance. I think as investment performance improved from 2005 into 6 and 7, the duration of the funding period shortened, and then when we went into 2008 and there's some negative financial performance, the duration started to extend out again. So the regulator responded to that fairly quickly and issued this release in October 2008. And the main issues in that first bullet point that came from the price falls and the pressures on covenants were that there was no intention to change the code of practice, and that to continue to balance funding levels with affordability. So at the end of the day, in the regulator's perspective, there is no point from a regulator's perspective trying to be overzealous in getting employers to contribute faster to fund deficits with the possible outcome that doing so would force them to go to the wall. So the best way to secure members' benefits is actually to keep the employer sponsor alive rather than forcing them into bankruptcy. Good practice was to keep the covenant under review, and it anticipated at the time that larger deficiencies and longer recovery periods would be anticipated as a result of the market falls. In February 2009, the regulator then issued a statement to employers that they were emphasising the need for flexibility in negotiating recovery plans where the employer sponsor was under some sort of financial pressure, and that the deficit should not push a viable business into insolvency. So it was clear that the regulator was taking a very considered approach to how this was happening. An interesting point here, which we can have some discussion and comment about later on in the Australian context, was that in the second part of that second bullet point, but equally the scheme should not suffer to enable the company to continue to pay dividends. So in other words, that if there was a detrimental change to the funding period over which a deficit was going to be made up, the regulator would take a dim view of the company if it was still able to afford to pay dividends to shareholders. So in other words, we're going to give some money to our equity holders,
but we're not going to give any extra money to our employees' pension provisions, which might be considered to be a debt holder. So that's an interesting element that I hadn't really thought about myself until now, is the impact of dividend payment policies for fund sponsors. The third point as well is around contingent asset security. And so there has been some work done, and done. Like some of my colleagues in the UK have done some work with a few case studies already, where they were working with a global firm. The parent of the firm was not a UK business, and in assessing the strength of the employer in looking at the funding of a deficit, they had the very open discussions with the subsidiary firm that was domiciled in the UK, and had discussions around looking through that corporate veil to make sure that the members and the employees, including some of management, had access to some security over future funding levels, and that the overseas parent wouldn't just walk away from those obligations if things went too bad. And so as a result of those discussions, the offshore parent was actually quite willing to put in place, in one case, some guarantees around its continued funding of the scheme, and in another case where they're able to actually secure some physical assets of the business that they've secured the future contributions against, to provide some security against future contributions that then ranked ahead of other creditors if in the event of wind-up. And I think the third point was just a bit of more of the same. So in assessing the employer covenant, some of the issues that were contemplated in the UK were around the financial analysis that was required. And the big key part is you can have a look at financial analysis, and that's one point, and that's where actuaries may think that they have a contribution to make. But it also involved a significant amount of research and interpretation around qualitative data. So the question then came, who has sufficient knowledge and expertise to perform such assessments? And also the issue of objectivity and conflicts of interest came up, certainly where the trustee boards in the UK, like in Australia, in the UK in particular, often the CFO or senior finance representatives are on the trustee board, yet they are also on, you know, a significant contributor to the employer's position. And so how those conflicts are managed was a key to the arguments as well. So these are a number of things that are considered by people performing these assessments in the UK. And if you look at the top left-hand corner, the second bullet point, the second point there, the net asset position, that's something that an accountant, actuary, others can assess. But what is the quality of the assets? That's the question for professionals giving advice in this area. Who has the ability and the knowledge and the experience to determine the quality of an asset? Looking on the right-hand side again, apart from the potentially curious position the actuary might be placed in making an assessment about the quality of management when talking with management, but who is actually in a position to make those assessments in this room, I guess, is the question we've got to ask ourselves. I've already mentioned down the bottom in the second point there is the where does the sponsor sit in the group? Is it sufficiently resourced, or is it reliant on overseas parent? All those questions start to give different answers to some of the questions we ask. On the bottom left-hand side, these are really, at the end of the day, the key questions. And in the Australian context, you know, we haven't really, I don't believe, given much thought to putting security over assets or getting agreement to rank superannuation contributions ahead of other liabilities in the event of wind-up and so forth. So, and the final point there is that these things are a moving feast, so that you don't necessarily sort of set a process in place and then forget it. So what KPIs can be identified for ongoing monitoring, so that as the financial position improves over time, if you have secured some of the assets of the business, or likewise, at what point can you start to release that security as the financial position of the pension fund or the superannuation fund improves? So there are a few times the question comes, when do you do it? Obviously, the triennial valuation is one time when you're signing off a PS400 actuarial valuation, that an assessment of the employer covenant, as was identified in six or seven parts of PS400, might be an issue. But also with ongoing monitoring, especially when their fund is in an unsatisfactory financial condition. Another time where an assessment might be important is where there's corporate activity such as a merger and acquisition, or in the case of a company going through a shareholder buyback. So it's altering the leverage position of the sponsoring employer where it might have an impact on the assessment of the employer covenant. So there's different opportunities or different times that we might want to think about reviewing or reassessing the employer covenant. I think that's a fairly self-explanatory side. I think there obviously are going to be negotiations between the employer and the trustee in some circumstances, not all. In most cases that I've been involved with, and I'm sure that most of you are the same, that agreement is reached fairly easily on the funding approach to be used, but there are times where that's not necessarily the case, and I've seen a few of those over the recent past. But obviously our key role as an actuarial profession is to always safeguard members' long-term financial security. We have an obligation not just to our client, but also a greater responsibility to the members of the fund and the profession as a whole, and to help trustees to meet their fiduciary responsibilities. So these are some of the reasons why we shouldn't do it. It's too difficult to do reliably. Who's the expert? How much will it cost to do a proper job? And what are the implications at the end of all this if there is actually a corporate failure? And this was some of the discussions that we had at the Superannuation Practice Committee, is that if members of the Institute provide advice and make an assessment based on whatever information, that the employer-sponsor covenant was satisfactory, and then in the following 2 or 3 year period, whilst that actual evaluation is still the most recent one, the employer sponsor goes bankrupt. What liabilities are left for the actuary who gave the advice that the security of the covenant was satisfactory? So there's also liability issues there for the actuary. I was thinking I might just pause here for a moment and see if there are any questions or comments. And I'm particularly more interested in comments from the floor, if there are any around some of the issues and what members' thoughts might be. I've got some other thoughts myself that I can talk through in a moment as part of this, but I'm just more interested today in any other comments from the floor about some of these issues. So we'll go first of all to the drafter of PS 400. Thanks,
Jeff. It's all my fault.
And just say your name.
Jeff Humphreys. In the UK, Andrew, are you saying it's the trustee's responsibility to determine the covenant, not the actuary's responsibility? So presumably the actuary can rely on the trustee's advice that the contributions are likely to come in, and so that would make our job a lot simpler, wouldn't it? And is that how they treat it in the UK, your colleagues?
I'm just now reaching for some extra notes on that. I should just add that another thing that the profession has done in the UK, and if you go onto the UK Institute website, there are two documents on the website. One is a presentation done by Richard Hall from Standard & Poor's on assessing the sponsor's covenant, and that's it's got some interesting information there, but it's not overly valuable. It's probably about a dozen slides or so. But the Institute in the UK did do a paper, or had a working party, which issued its report in November 2005. So it was the Sponsor Covenant Working Party final report. And if you look inside here, some of the things that the working party in its recommendations, and there were a handful of those, and I should just read them out. So we recommend that the Pensions Board adopts and publicises two pensions actuaries the view that before advising on the assessment of a sponsor's covenant in relation to actuarial advice, actuaries should consider carefully whether or not they are competent to do so. And, B, the actuarial training and typical actuary's experience is unlikely by itself to provide an actuary with this competence. So it was actually the recommendation of the UK Institute was to get the regulator to give specific guidance that just being an actuary meant that you probably shouldn't do this, that you actually needed to have wider experience or wider training to be able to do a proper job of assessing the employer-sponsor covenant. Um,
Now, I'm just trying to look for the area where it did have mention of the trustee. Before I do that, this was another... There was a key decision that was required in relation to the assessment. And when giving funding advice, this working party recommended that actuarial funding advice should first distinguish between whether the schemes are... And they've come up with two different labels, whether the schemes are either viable ongoing or in distress. And so wherever that advice came from, whether it's the trustee or from another party, the first thing before framing the advice and taking account of the explicit sponsor covenant, you had to make a decision whether it was viable, ongoing or in distress, which still requires a lot of judgment, but it's significant how they framed that, just in distress. And apart from making a determination that an employer sponsor is already in distress, apart from that, you can basically ignore it, seems to be the approach. And so that timing of when a company goes from being viable ongoing to being in distress can be a fine line, as we saw with Ansett in 2001, where they were probably viable ongoing about an hour before two aeroplanes crashed into some buildings in New York, when they immediately became in distress. Now, let's have a look. Yeah, it didn't go on in any of this to say about whether the trust, you could rely on, there's a lot of hands, whether you could rely on the trustee's assessment of that, but I think we're taking that if you've got a, that's really the only thing the actuary had to decide on, was whether the company was in distress or not. So I think that hopefully that answers the question in part.
Mike Murphy, just one comment on that. I can't help you with the facts of whether the trustee did or didn't. I don't know the UK situation, but it occurs to me that whatever was done, particularly in the 2005 report, it was in the context of a freestanding fund with a trustee somewhat related to a single employer. And the really interesting thing in the Australian environment is the multi-employer master trust or industry fund scenario.
Yeah, and how well the assets are protected from within sub-funds within a master fund context from the... I thought you might be able to provide some more light on that. Does seeing your employer might run one of those funds?
Well, yes, indeed. I was thinking it from the perspective of the trustee making an assessment of the employer to tell the actuary that particular question, where the trustee is completely unrelated to the employer. It might make it a little handier to be able to give an opinion of management, but not in practice, one would imagine.
Yeah.
And yes, in terms of sub-plans, where the typical experience of most funds would be that the assets of the sub-plan are quarantined for that sub-plan and not available to the others, but the trustee does have an issue with that, where it has any of these sub-plans in deficit and the funding positions that the trustee is attempting to deal with to ensure that they not only don't drive individual employers out of business, but don't put at risk both their employees and, for that matter, the sponsor of the fund as much as the employers in the other DB sub-plans.
Yeah. It's Matthew, I think, was next, and then one over the other side. Oh, Paul was up first earlier, so go for it, Paul, then Matthew, then over the back.
Paul Shalhoub. I did have a look at some of the literature off the TPR website, and, my impression was that the obligation sits fairly and squarely with the trustee. Hmm. Now, it does impact largely on the actuary, who is responsible for working with the trustee and the employer, I guess, in framing the remediation program. In my other extensive preparation for this, so I had a 5-minute chat with an actuary who used to work in the UK, and this was just coming, I guess, starting to happen when he was there, but his impression was that at that time approaches ranged from the trustees having a bit of applying their knowledge of the circumstances of the employer to say that, they believed it was in good shape, et cetera, et cetera, to employing one of the accounting firms to prepare a detailed report on, the financial position, et cetera, of the employer sponsor. Yep. So that would clearly add very significant cost to any exercise. And when we get to employer sponsors with four members left in their defined benefit plan, it's probably starting to become. Yeah, it would add significantly, and there might be a materiality issue, which is important to take into account. The other point, I guess, I was thinking of is that the period of the remediation program, I guess, has an impact on how far out you need to look at the financial position and strength of the employer. And in Australia, we certainly have much shorter remediation programs than they tend to do in the UK. Just perhaps to add another comment to that, which works in the other direction, we have relatively few, but there are some, I guess, defined benefit pension funds. And in most cases, the employer-sponsored defined benefit funds are funded on a basis which effectively relies on future employer support. So I guess in that sort of situation, we have a much longer-term reliance, if you like, on the employer being around to support the fund. So I just thought I'd perhaps throw in those couple of thoughts to the discussion.
And while you're moving up to the back, I think on that latter point as well, it's presuming also that the employer is permitted by law to contribute to a pension fund when there's only pensioners left in the fund, because at the moment that's doubtful.
Okay, it seems like all the SCBPC and other people who have been thinking about this a lot are commenting, but I wonder in the UK...
Who are you?
Oh, Matthew Burgess.
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin.
In the UK, I don't know a lot about the UK situation, but in Australia, employers don't need to contribute. The actuary can make any recommendation we like, and the employer has no obligation to make those contributions. I mean, the actuary would need to report them to APRA that the employer has not made the contributions recommended by the actuary. APRA has no power whatsoever if the fund is not technically insolvent, if it is only in an unsatisfactory financial position, has limited authority. I imagine in the UK that the trustees or the pension regulator have some power to force employers to contribute, because I can't see how that UK regime can work without that, so I'd be interested in knowing whether that was the case. In the Australian context, it seems to me that actuaries are in an awkward position because given the uncertainty, as soon as we try to take into account the employer covenant and get it wrong, there's liability issues. If we say a three-year funding program is appropriate and the company goes belly up after one, what happens? It would seem to me much better if CIS was amended, as the Institute has suggested, to focus on unsatisfactory financial positions, that actuaries are required to put in place funding plans to rectify unsatisfactory financial positions over 3 years or whatever the time period may be, that if a longer time frame is desired by the employer, then there's the ability for the employer to work with APRA to negotiate that APRA has the ability to take into account the financial circumstances of the company, whether it's a multi-employer fund, whether it's a government fund. And in my way of thinking, a lot of this approach can kind of avoid actuaries having to get into commenting on the financial strength of employers. And I know Andrew knows that I don't feel actuaries are qualified to do that.
I did some research just to prove your point. That was the... And just while you're moving the microphone over to the far side for the moment, I think in talking to the UK colleagues, the typical price that's paid, so if you go to a Big Four accounting firm or other professionals that provide this, a typical price was in the range of about £18,000 to £36,000, real money. And depending on the complexity of the situation, because obviously in the UK, you know, large pension funds that were material to given the size of the employer, there was at least one instance where a project was conducted by a consulting firm that was over £1 million to assess the employer's covenant. So that might have forced the employer out of business in having to pay that bill. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, next.
Thanks, Andrew. Janice Jones.
Just a comment, picking up on that, how do we know someone's in distress? Having had an employer go into administration, you don't really know they're in distress until they're in administration. Or, and I think that we really can't add much more value in predicting the timing of that. And if S&P can't get it right, at what point can unexperienced actuaries, possibly with no accounting specific knowledge, deal with it? So I think we have to leave that in the hands of the market, as it were. When a company's in distress, you usually know about it. And a comment to that is, if you have a multi-employer fund with employer representatives in the room at the trustee or policy committee, they are in a very difficult position. One of them may be attempting to buy the other one. Individual staff may know what's going on at their own company and be anxious about that, but no one can discuss it. So I don't think you can expect a trustee composed of employer staff of the companies, whether they're employer or employee reps, to be able to also make that minuted discussion of which employer is looking good and which employers are in trouble. Tricky one. But what we have learned is that that risk management plan can be really bad or it can be very useful. As an employer goes into distress, the trustees of a DB fund should know in advance what their options are. What does their deed say? How will they work with an administrator who only has an SG compliance problem and has no interest in any benefits more generous than the MRB? Because that's all the administrator has to deal with. If a trustee can think that through and actually say, well, it's never going to happen, but if it did, here's our course of action, I think they'd find themselves in a much better position. And perhaps the actuary's role is just to help them think that through in a non-judgmental sort of environment. All your employers are doing well, let's just think about what would happen.
Yeah, and whilst the microphone's moving again, I was unfortunately one of a few actuaries who were involved in the Ansett case when it went through. And the law hasn't changed in this regard since that took place. And one of the interesting developments that occurred with that was, as Matthew pointed out before, is that there's no action taken by APRA until insolvency is reached. And the unfortunate situation that happened with the Ansett case was that Lindsay Fox, in trying to do the right thing to keep some jobs and an airline afloat, that meant that a number of people remained employed for significant periods of time after the 13th of September 2000 or the 12th of September 2001 when it was first declared or going under administration. And at the timing at which people left their jobs, progressively, you know, they reduced the number of flights that were going, so then some flight attendants would be then laid off, and then some engineers would be laid off, and then some pilots would be laid off, and it progressively happened over a long period of time. And in working through the machinations of the insolvency provisions within SIS, it meant that every single person who left the business until the minute that it became insolvent got 100% of their vested benefit. And then every person who was left thereafter got the MRB, which was about 40% lower. And it was completely unlawful to do any other more equitable situation where everybody from the 12th of September onwards got 97% of their benefit, which was in what the fund I was dealing with. It was only in a 3% below the line. And that was in a period where markets had fallen, you know, 15% in a couple of days, and so every accumulation fund member in Australia lost 15% of their benefit. Here were some members who might have been able to negotiate a way to lose 3% of their benefit and be sort of better off, but the law required you to pay 100% to most of the people, and then the last people standing who were trying to keep the company afloat then got screwed. You know, so there's an issue in all of that as well. There's a question there.
Just probably a bit of background on the UK to help the conversation. Clearly, I can't hide my accent. In terms of the UK...
Sorry, what was your name? For
Rachel Best. The position there with the pensions is you're looking at much longer-term deferred annuities for people who exit, whereas over in Australia we have vested benefits and we pay out on exit. So there's a significant difference there in terms of the immediate impact on the security of the remaining members in the fund. The UK pensions are not as mature. The schemes are not as mature as they are here in Australia. You have younger average ages and bigger funds. And also, the position if you were to buy out the pension funds actually in the annuity market in the UK, there'd be about 50% funded, That was when I left the UK 2.5 years ago. I dread to think what they are now. So it is a little bit different in the UK as to how this has come about. Just to answer a question about what happens if the company doesn't pay, or what does the regulator do? Well, you have to have a discussion then between the trustee and the company and work out a different situation. In terms of the timeframes as to when you actually have to pay the money back, we're saying, like, in the UK it's typically 7 to 9 years, and that's again a function of the fact that you're looking at long-term deferred annuities on exits. You're not looking at money paid out immediately. The companies that did the independent assessments on the covenant, they looked at investment ratios and things like that, and it was specialists in business analytics. It typically wasn't actuaries that did that kind of work. And just looking at all that together in context, and the fact that, as I mentioned here, we don't know when a company is in distress until it is, I question the materiality of the employer covenant in this market.
Yeah, and I think that pension fund issue is what we were talking about before, is significant in the materiality. And I just I briefly made a comment before on some pension fund issues. We had the discussion at the practice committee over a few meetings around, first of all, it started on the ability to claim for an employer to claim a tax deduction for shortfalls in pension liabilities, so that if the assets supporting your pension liabilities fell and there was a deficit in respect of your pension liabilities, can you top it up? And you get a tax deduction for it. And also, even if you just used a different mortality basis and the value of the liabilities became larger, even if the assets were still sufficient to support the liabilities under the previous valuation. And whilst we have a way of working around that in Australia, where as long as you've got active employees in there, you can sort of all contributions go in respect of the active employees. If you actually, and there, I believe there's one fund that's just got pensioners in it now, and there may be more, but if there's just pensioners in the fund, the employer can only claim a tax deduction in respect of employees. And there's a lot of doubt about whether you can actually claim it in respect of former employees, certainly if they haven't worked for the employer for more than 6 months, because there is a late contributions permission to actually make contributions and be deductible. But on top of that, it then evolved in conversation that you can only make contributions at all if someone had been working within, you know, it's the work test for making contributions to a fund at all. And that if none of the pensioners had actually worked for a period of time, then it was actually against the law to make any further contributions to that fund, which is interesting. Kevin's got in before.
Kevin O'Sullivan, can you go back to your first slide? The UK, that one. The very last one there, paragraph 101, where it talks about affordability. I guess I'm just concerned that I wouldn't like to see something like that in Australia. Mm-hmm. In relation to my clients, that if they were a corner store, I think that's a different story. But if you have a large corporate who can't afford to pay money in, but for whatever reason they say, I don't need to put in $10 million to actually get rid of a deficit because I can afford it, but I know the markets are going to recover in the next 2 years. So stuff that. So I, my point is really just a comment. I would not like to see something like that in Australia.
That's a good point. I mean, it's the interesting part about that is that just because an employer can afford it doesn't mean that they necessarily want to put it in because of what I view mainly as the restrictive approach in our regulation to getting surplus back out of the fund. And in fact, our regulatory environment here, I've got a couple of clients, one client in particular that's got over 10,000 employees, 87 of them now are in the defined benefit fund, and they have absolutely no inclination whatsoever to ever have the vested benefit index above 100%, because they want it to be at 99.9% when the last person leaves, and they put in the extra dollar for the person to get their benefit, and it's done and dusted. They don't want to have excess money left in the fund and have an argy-bargy over that after the last person leaves. So our regulatory approach on surplus repatriation is now causing issues for defined benefit funds, which is a different issue that probably when everything was framed, and globally it's the same, It was always framed in an ongoing situation, not envisaging specific situations now where all funds in a particular jurisdiction are essentially in wind-up mode, whether that's over a 3-year period or 20-year period or 30-year period.
So Andy Chen from the Commonwealth Bank, and unfortunately one of part of my daytime job is to deal with our UK. We have a very small UK fund there. My understanding of what that part is that it's part of a legislative reform package that actually included a government protection fund. So, and what the pension regulator was really looking for was to say that you've got to do everything possible to make sure that if the fund goes busted, you won't be calling on that government protection fund. That's what this is. That's what this is. And the practical experience in the UK now that it was brought in after the 2000 market crash and given the GFC is that they do actually want people to put money in when they can afford it, because the problem is that the time that they need the money is right now, and every employer is going to get to go and tell you, I can't afford it. I think that's where it seems to be coming from. So what unfortunately, if you look at the next slide, one element that was the pension regulator was pushing very much was actually that the wasn't so much getting a deficit fund over 10 years or whatever, but actually making sure that you got adequate, your provisions are not being reduced because, by the way, the employer wants you to reduce it and to make the whole funding position look a little bit better than what it is.
That's the PPF or something that's called in the UK, which I think you're right, that does make a difference to having a call on that would make a difference to how the regulator would want to see the funds going in. Paul.
Just on the question of... Paul Shalhoub again. Just on the question of putting more money in for pensioners, in the budget last Tuesday. Feels like a long time ago.
It was only a couple of days ago, mate. You've been working since then.
The government listed a number of things, minor amendments, so-called minor amendments, one of which was to, I can't remember exactly how it was put, but effectively to introduce further flexibility in regard to the timing of contributions in respect of former employees. That could be very limited. It could just mean we're going to give you 12 months rather than 6 months or 3 months or whatever it is now. The Institute has requested, an amendment to allow specifically contributions to be made for pensioners. So we would hope that reference might signal that they might be going to do something accommodating in that area as well. And APRA is quite aware of that deficiency in the regulations at the moment. I think they're supporting legislative change in that area as well. Thanks.
Just some of the other comments that one of the things that I thought that the implications of all of this were that at least having a conversation about some of these issues might help improve employer understanding of some of the issues, and certainly the dividend policy part that we talked about earlier for the UK, just in that conversation we just had then around employers not wanting to have surpluses and this inability to get surpluses back, all the complications to go through in doing so, would mean that you certainly wouldn't want to have restrictive practices on dividend policies simply because they don't want to put in a couple of $1,000s into a super fund to make a solvent again. Around putting security over specific assets, so if even a smallish fund that might have a $2 or $3 million shortfall, is there any benefit seen in actually bothering to go through some formal process to put security over particular assets to make that more secure? One of the things that I had thought about as another opportunity for comment was in an accumulation fund, unpaid contributions from last month or 2 months ago. So in the ANZAC case, any contributions that were in respect of last month's payroll that hadn't yet hit the fund, they were regarded as unpaid contributions and have a priority ranking over creditors, or certainly unsecured creditors. And that in thinking through the AASB approach to accounting for superannuation funds and the possibility, I'm not sure where that ended up, with putting the liabilities on the balance sheet and so having a surplus. And basically, in order to follow normal accounting principles for a balance sheet to then balance, you then need to have another line that says, you know, the asset for unpaid future contributions or a liability for, you know, any surplus that's currently in there at the time. If we actually went down that path, that could have the perverse issue of saying, well, the deficit is actually unpaid future contributions, and the legislation should be changed to give an all unpaid future contributions, so treat DB unpaid future contributions as a priority ranking, as same as accumulation fund, and a priority ranking over unsecured debtors in the event of a company wind-up. I mean, are there any thoughts on that?
Just a comment that I think in our Cooper submission, Matthew? That was one of the questions Cooper asked. You know, should there be any consideration given to the ranking of superannuation liabilities on wind-up? And the Institute view put was that consideration should be given to having DB shortfalls ranking ahead of other creditors, so the same ranking as for unpaid DC member contributions.
Yeah. No one in the room would be not supportive of that view. I mean, that would simplify a whole lot of things, I guess, if that was the situation, because I think in the Ansett case that would have meant that, you know, those contributions were certainly all would have been available prior to the creditors getting their share. It does have some potential impact then that creditors will want to have some understanding of the financial position of the fund before entering into loans with the employer. But I guess these days with the corporate accounting, it's on the balance sheet of the company's accounts for everyone to see anyway, so it should be taken into account already.
Mike Murphy again. When you mentioned that, Andrew, I heard you say all future employer-defined benefit contributions, but I deduced from subsequent discussion we're quarantining that to contributions funding prior service deficits, effectively.
Yes.
So that's fine.
So loose terminology.
I presume. Well, I wasn't sure what you meant, but the clarifying discussion made it fairly clear that was clearly what you meant. And the second point, just going back to quarantining specific assets, again, in the typical nature of the Australian situation where we're talking relatively small amounts and relatively against employers and things, that just seems to me, without having ever thought of it before, but the inconvenience of an employer in trying, whether it's even a couple of $1 million or whatever, for some employers might be significant, but to do something with their business management, which was put specific charge over specific assets, is normally quite a big deal. And so I think that would be pretty impractical for the vast majority of employers.
And I might add to that, in terms of that, I know that some employers actually have bank guarantees, so that's in a similar vein, but you're not having to charge against assets.
They're not cheap, though, are they?
No, they're not. Not cheap.
No, especially with...
And they don't last very long, so you've got to roll them over, so they only provide so much security.
Yep.
Any other comments, questions?
Maybe Andrew just finished with where we wound up with PS400.
Where did we end up with PS400? We still haven't finished up with PS400. but certainly in our... in our discussions that in the drafting going forward, that we didn't specifically, and I think I sort of alluded to it earlier, that we didn't want to put this onus on actuaries, because independently of all the information we've subsequently looked at, that it was just felt that it was going to be way too onerous, and all it would ultimately do, as we've discussed earlier, would be subject the actuary to a liability when a company went under, having an actuary just having said that it was okay. And as was said earlier, you never know when a company's going into distress until it's actually in distress. You don't get the 5-minute warning bell that says, look out, tomorrow's going to be a big day for us. So in the end, we've tried to, in the drafting, choose our words very carefully to protect the actuary from liability and making assessments about future funding plans and the ongoing viability of the sponsoring employer. It was a useful discussion. I just wanted to, and the reason for putting it on the agenda for this conference was basically to have some of this discussion and some of the ideas that we had. We found the discussion quite useful at the practice committee level, and to share some of those comments, thoughts, views, and other problems that we've come across in our experiences with a wider group, to make sure that we all have a an opportunity to contribute to that debate and have a common understanding. So thanks for coming along today and sharing in the discussion.
And thank me for... join me in thanking Andrew.